program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Dell, and AVU Technologies. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by AFGE 6th District National Vice President Arnold Scott, National VA Council 3rd Executive Vice President Bill Wetmore, and 1st District Representative BJ Ocker. But first, hear Ward's interview with Congressman John Sarbanes.
Welcome back to Inside Government, Congressman Sarbanes.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
So let's talk about President Obama recently signing your Telework Enhancement Act of 2010. Tell us about the bill.
Well, I was thrilled that we finally got it to the president's desk. We've been working on it for a while. It was a bipartisan bill. We had support from both Republicans and Democrats. And the basic idea was to bring teleworking into the federal workforce at a higher level. There have been some agencies, as you know, that have embraced it more than others, and they've found when they do so that productivity goes up, morale increases. There's all kinds of cost savings and efficiencies that you achieve, and we wanted to make sure that there was a law in the books that said telework's a good thing. We ought to try to embrace it. We ought to create policies within the agencies and people that are focused on how this can be made more widely available. And my view is it meets many, many different objectives, and we can talk about those, but probably first and foremost, it allows the federal government to go into the marketplace and recruit people because we're being as nimble as any other employer is when we offer telework.
Now, obviously, there's a cost savings to taxpayers, for instance, when the federal government might have in the past shut down for weather or some other emergency, and now people can work from home. But let's talk about how we kind of incentivize when there's a non-emergency situation to get sort of that middle level of management to start being a little more progressive about doing this for people on the front lines.
The way you do that, I think, is you just begin to develop a culture within each agency's workplace that telework is central to the mission of the agency. And that's why in the past it's been sort of, you know, I guess random or uneven in terms of whether telework is really part of what goes on in an agency, because it depended heavily on whether the leadership in that agency decided to pursue it. What we're trying to do with the legislation that's now been signed, and I must say, with tremendous cooperation from John Berry, the head of OPM, in this, is to create a more uniform commitment to telework across the federal workplace. And you do that by saying, look, every agency, you know, as this bill does, every agency has to have policies in place that describe the opportunity for telework. Every agency is going to have a telework managing officer, somebody whose responsibility it is to make sure those policies are widely known to the workers and to help guide them in figuring out what the best opportunity for telework is. And you know, there's a lot of flexibility within that, but the idea is this won't be an afterthought anymore. It'll be integrated into the overall approach in each agency. And so it's that kind of uniform commitment to telework that the legislation was designed to promote, and I think it will do that.
Are there any carrots and sticks in there, incentives to maybe, you know, foster this more, or, you know, any kind of penalties if people aren't really performing with this?
Well, when you're talking about individuals, I think it's really just making it clear to them that a telework is a critical part of the agency's approach. Because in the past, you know, there have been people who worry, you know, if I raise the topic to my supervisor in an environment where not a lot of people are doing telework, am I somehow going to be penalized for that? And so, you know, people might have been more reticent about exploring it. Now they'll know that because there's policies being put forward, that there's materials, that there's training opportunities, that there's a person they can go to find out more about the telework, I think they'll be much more comfortable about pursuing that on their own. So in that sense, I guess that's a carrot, right, to create that environment. The stick part of it might be you know, people who've been reluctant to even think about teleworking as part of their job. Now that there's somebody within the agency and there's policies and other attention to it, they're going to be forced to at least give it consideration. And what you end up with is the kind of dialogue between the workforce and the sort of supervisory part of the staff on the benefits of telework and where that can be best taken advantage of. So it's really about creating a culture. And what's interesting is if you look at the agencies, for example, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has been very progressive in their telework policies before now even. If you look at agencies that have embraced it, not only do they show enhanced productivity and so forth among those who are teleworking, but in fact, because they get more focused on sort of results and performance and how to measure that, they've improved their productivity across their entire workforce, both among those who are teleworking and those who are not. And that's the kind of efficiency and productivity that you want to promote any way you can across the federal workforce. Telework is one way of doing that.
And, you know, this really is a win-win. It's a win for the employees, but it also makes government more productive, as you point out. Have there been some studies, like you're kind of mentioning with Patent and Trademark or any other places, maybe GAO has done to show some of these cost savings to taxpayers?
Some of the agencies have been able to demonstrate, for example, that they don't need to lease as much space to house their workforce because they have telework arrangements in place where people can be working from home. I want to also mention that, you know, as you promote telework, you start looking at the opportunity to create telework centers. So, you know, it may not be your home that you're working from. It may be a satellite location that you can go to, but it's still not requiring you to go into the agency proper. And there's efficiencies that are achieved that way. So there are agencies that have been able to demonstrate the results. Of course, when we had those snowstorms last February that shut the government down for 3 days, there were people who were able to continue their operations. This continuity of operations piece is very critical in terms of what telework can offer. And the estimate was that the government saved $30 million a day that would have been lost otherwise in terms of, you know, lost productivity because people were able to continue to operate and perform their duties during the snowstorm because they could do it remotely. So there's plenty of evidence that there's significant savings. The other thing, of course, is the private sector has embraced this for a long time. You look at you know, some of the country's best corporations. They do this, and they do it because it helps their bottom line. If it's helping their bottom line, it's because it's increasing efficiency and productivity and it's saving them money. And we're showing that the federal government can do that just as well.
And in this day and age when, you know, the federal government has budget issues, obviously there's talk of this freeze that, of course, all the federal employees are very upset by. But if you're trying to recruit the best and the brightest of federal service, this seems to be almost a no-brainer.
I agree. And if you can go into a competitive marketplace for the workforce and you can say, here are the various benefits, flexibility that we can offer you as a federal employee, you're going to get people's attention. And John Berry, I think, understood this from the day he arrived in his role as head of OPM, and that's why he was very, very committed to it. We worked collaboratively with him. He saw the wisdom, I think, of having a statute on the books, having legislation that makes this commitment, so that regardless of who happens to be, you know, heading up OPM or in charge of a particular agency going forward, they're going to understand that the law has created an expectation that they invest and commit to telework. So we are very pleased to get this finally on the books, and I think the president, from his comments when we were at the signing ceremony the other day, certainly understands the benefits that it's going to bring.
Now, if you're a federal employee at the worksite and you're hearing about this now and you go, wow, this is something I really want to do, when does this really kick in? Does it kick in right away?
As far as I understand, it will kick in. Well, first of all, as I mentioned, the Office of Personnel Management has already been working hand in glove with each agency to make sure that they're focusing on this. So I know that that's already underway, and I would be surprised if, federal employees haven't gotten some word that this is a real opportunity for them already. But what will help to further kind of reinforce that is that there are specific reporting requirements and evaluation pieces that we also included in the legislation. And I believe that the first one of those is due within 6 months or a year. I know that each agency is required to begin implementing a telework policy, establishing a telework policy within a year of enactment, and the Office of Personnel Management is meant to issue regulations on telework within 180 days of enactment. So you're going to begin seeing activity very soon at the agency level that will reflect the commitment this legislation calls for. And certainly any federal worker who's listening to this and is excited about the prospect is in a position to now go to the powers that be within their agency and say, I understand that the commitment's been made. I'm interested in it. I'd like to understand what the policies and opportunities are going to be. I think they'll find a receptive audience for that.
As we come down to our last minute, when you next go before the Greater Baltimore Committee in your area and talk to them about this legislation and how it might impact, say, transportation, the environment, are we talking about teleworking maybe one day a week, or could it be as much as 4 or 5 days a week?
There's a lot of flexibility. The expectation when we were working on the legislation is that you would kind of view telework as at least 20%. So that's one day a week. But what we've discovered in talking with the agencies that have been more proactive about this is the more they get comfortable with it, the more they pursue it, obviously. And so you increase the amount of time that may be committed through telework. I want to make the point that, in some instances, telework's not going to work, is not going to be appropriate. There's certain kinds of jobs that involve, sensitive information and other things, or where you have to be on a site to do the job, where telework's not going to be really an option. And we were sensitive to that as we were developing the legislation. The point is to try to create open-mindedness about this so that the workforce has as much flexibility to pursue it as they can. And I think you're going to see that happen.
And we thank you for your efforts on that. We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Save 10, 20, even 30% on PCs from Dell. Only Dell can offer AFGE members the guaranteed lowest price through their member purchase program. Visit Dell.com/AFGE for details.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by AFGE 6th District National Vice President Arnold Scott. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Now, we've got you here today at the VA Council's 20th Triennial Training Convention in L.A. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing here and what you've seen so far.
Well, what I'm doing here, I was here with the VA Council, which was conducting training, and I had a lot of locals from the 6th District that are VA locals that was participating in the convention here.
And what are some of your members telling you about their experiences so far in the training and education piece?
What they're telling me is they love it. They think it's a great thing. Every couple of years they come and they have the convention here, and They really like it. This is the first time I've been to a VA council convention. And, I mean, I really had, really, I'm having a great time here.
And they do a great job in promoting the training and education piece, not only here, but throughout the year. Could you talk about how important it is to have our members, our stewards, our activists trained and educated in the issues that they're fighting for?
Well, I think when you talk about training, period, within AFG, we do a lot of training. If you talk about the VA Council, I mean, I think it's extremely important that the stewards and the officers understand the issues and they know what it is that they need to do in order to protect the employees that we represent on the job, to represent them.
And what kind of training do you initiate in District 6?
Well, I do all type training, do stewards training, do officers training, you know, there's various types of training that we do within the 6th District. We do multi-district training where we include the VA piece in there. Mm-hmm. We do a piece on Title 38 that we normally do.
Expand upon that a little bit, the Title 38 part of it.
Well, the Title 38 is those nurses who are, instead of being covered by collective bargaining, like everybody else, and when you talk about the rights that they have, the rights are limited that they have, where most federal employees can file something with the Merit System Protection Board, they have to go before a panel of their peers, and their peers determine whether they receive the discipline that management is proposing for them.
And doesn't that seem a little bit strange that almost much like our TSOs, some of these employees don't have these basic workplace rights that they should have?
Yes, it is. It's strange. And I do know that the VA Council has been working real hard on the 7422, where the secretary can come in at any time and just declare that something is a 7422 issue, and they have no rights. I mean, it's basically done at that point. You know, they deserve the same rights and the same protection that every federal workers get. And also they deserve to have a fair play, you know, in a process that allows fair play for them.
A level playing field that is pretty standard for everyone then, right?
Yes, yes, I would say so.
Now, I think the last time that we had you on the program, you and I talked at length about some issues at the Defense Finance and Accounting Services and some troubles there with the employees. Is there any update on that?
Well, the only thing that I know right now is I know that the case that was going to be decided by the Merit System Protection Board, the agency asked that it be dismissed. And the Merit System Protection Board, because there's so many cases out there where they've removed federal workers, and from our point of view, without just cause, the Merit System Protection Board has said that they're going to hear the case, and they have heard the case, and AFGE argued the case on behalf of those workers. We're waiting on a decision back from them. We haven't received one yet, but we're hoping that it's going to go in our favor.
And what would that look like? What would a decision look like that, in your mind, would be successful or have accomplished its goal?
I would think that if you're talking about accomplish the goal, bring the employees back to work. I mean, employees shouldn't be fired just because they have bad credit ratings, just like every other American out here today. I mean, everybody, the economy is bad, and, you know, for federal workers, it's no different for them, you know. I mean, they have the same problems that every other worker has out here, and to terminate employees solely based upon a credit rating, I don't believe it's fair.
And certainly at a time when, as you mentioned, the economy is down and people are struggling to make ends meet, that putting even more people out of work in addition to the already high unemployment rate would be troublesome for people.
Yeah, I think that you're right when you say that. You know, I've always said that if you put an employee out of work because of their credit rating, you're not solving the problem. I mean, because basically that employee is leaving the federal government. Now they don't have a job, and where they couldn't make arrangements to pay their debtors, which most of them have done that, and the agency has basically come back and said that the arrangements that you made is not acceptable. It's like the agency has become the collection agent for all of these debtors out here, and it's just not helping the employees. You know, I would think that if they want to do something to help the employees, that they would come up with something, some type of program where when an employee gets in a has a problem with their finances, that employee can come to them and go receive some credit counseling or something to assist them to get things straight. And then if that employee doesn't get it straight, then I could see maybe where they would do something about it, but at least give the employee an opportunity to try to clear up the debt. And in most cases, you know, I mean, you've got cases where the employee is disputing the debt that some credit agency or some company says that they owe. And, you know, they should be allowed to go through the process just like anybody else to straighten that situation out.
Of course, to determine, one, if the debt is legitimate, and, two, if it is, to work towards paying that debt off so right. that it's taken care of. Because if an employee is unemployed, no longer has a job, well, they certainly won't be paying off the debt then if they don't
That's
have any
fact.
Income.
That's a fact. It doesn't make the situation any better. It just makes it worse, and it puts the employee in a bad situation. I've seen employees that have been paying off the debt and made arrangements to pay off the debt. The agency terminates them, and now all of a sudden they got to file bankruptcy. They're homeless. You know, they get in a situation where they're homeless. I mean, it's just uncalled for and unnecessary, you know.
Absolutely. Well, as you know, now we're in a time and in a culture where people are wanting to scale back, taking aim at the federal government and its workers in those efforts. And I was wondering if you could, just for a minute, talk to us about what that would mean in terms of real-life impact when people are saying we should be scaling back the workforce or not filling positions or removing people from positions. I mean, those have real-life consequences, not only for the people impacted by it, but the services that the federal government provides.
You know, I truly don't believe that the American public really understands what it is that the federal workers do and what impact it has on their lives, you know. If you talk about inspecting meat, you know, I've said time and time again, if you say that you're going to cut the budget, then what is it that you want us to do less of it? Do you want us to do less inspection of the foods? You want to turn that over to the companies to inspect their own food? You know, do you want us to not take care of the veterans? You know, if you talk about defense, what is it that you want us to do in support of the military? You want us to support the military less? You know, when you talk about cutting the budget, it has consequences on these federal agencies. And I just really don't believe that the American taxpayer supports what it is that this crazy Congress that just got elected is proposing. When you talk about furloughing employees, I mean, that has an impact on the employee. That's a loss of income for them. You know, you and I was just talking about employees not being able to pay their debts now. It's going to make that even worse. I mean, now all of a sudden, employees not going to get it, not going to get the money that they need in order to pay the bill that they're trying to pay. I mean, it's some of this stuff is just crazy that's being proposed. I mean, for federal workers at least.
And I think you bring up a great point, asking the question: well, okay, where is it that we cut back? What do we do? Do we cut back a federal prison system that's already understaffed and underfunded as it is?
Yeah.
I mean, we know
very well what those dangers could be in many, many, many other situations and other positions in the federal workforce and the federal government where cutting back is the least desirable option.
I mean, I think one of the things that concerns me the most, I mean, one of the issues that concerns me the most is when they talk about cutting education. I mean, these are our kids that they're talking about. If you cut back on education, what does that mean? To me, what it means to me is that less teachers in the classroom, which means that the class sizes are going to be bigger, and that means that the kids are not going to get the attention that they need in order to be successful. You know, we keep talking about wanting to have this education system the second to none. You don't build that by cutting back. You know, it just doesn't happen.
And education really is the foundation of our society. How can we expect our young people to grow into adults with, you know, extensive backgrounds and areas and research if they just don't have the foundation to get there as young people?
Well, I think that what you say is true. You know, I'm thinking about when you talk about education and you talk about our kids, you know, if you cut the education, I just don't see how it's going to make things better. I see how it's going to make things worse. I mean, you look at the dropout rate right now with kids. I mean, it's not going to get any better. I mean, we need to invest more into it, I think. And I know a lot of people say that, you know, this is a bureaucrat talking, just wanting to build up the federal government, but I don't think that's the issue at all. I think that when I think about my grandkids, I want them to have the best education that they can get. And if you talk about the public schools, I mean, I went to a public school, and, you know, I think I got a good education out of it. So I think that if we put the money in it that we need, then we'll get the results that we're looking for.
AFGE 6th District National Vice President Arnold Scott, always a pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jason.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, did you know you have free access to all federal government job listings at your fingertips? Through AFGE's partnership with AVIEW Technologies, you can view all available jobs, apply online, and be notified when a position of interest to you becomes available. View your application progress online 24/7. You'll even get information to make you a better job applicant. Simplify your next career move with AVIEW Technologies. Log on today and check out current job openings at afge.us. That's www.afge.us and click register.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government. But listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Bill Wetmore, the third executive vice president of AFGE's National VA Council. Welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back, Jason.
We're here today at the NVAC's 20th Triennial Training Convention in beautiful Los Angeles. Give us some highlights from the convention so far.
Oh, the convention has been running very smoothly, actually. We're real pleased with the hotel. We're very pleased with the training space that we've got. I think the election went very smoothly.
And talk about some of the training sessions that are going on here today for the members.
Training is going to happen starting about 1 o'clock today. And then on Wednesday, we'll have two sessions, morning and afternoon sessions, about 4 hours each. And then on Friday, the final morning session, the classes involve training on the contract, and particularly the articles that were rolled over as a consequence of the recent negotiations that were just completed in September. And then they're also training on the collective bargaining process, training on wellness to get people to deal with their stress is the focus of that kind of training. There's training on legislative issues. There's training on Title 38 issues, training on hybrid issues. I think the full gamut of the experience in VA is being taken up, and we also have training on grievances and arbitrations that are being done by our legal representative, Amy Prendergast.
What I'm getting from you is training, training, and more training.
Absolutely, Jason.
And it sounds like this is just in line with what the VA Council has always been about, which is training and educating its members.
We have a big desire to bring all the members up to be the most educated stewards and representatives that they can be. We feel that an educated steward is a dangerous steward, and their effective representation is based on what they know. If we know more and we have a desire to have them know more than the HR people know, we believe that that's the way to successfully represent our bargaining unit.
And what's the response that you've gotten from the membership on these training sessions?
Oh, the membership is overwhelmingly very pleased with the training that they're getting. We've gotten some excellent instructors. I mentioned Amy before. We're very pleased with Amy as our legal representative. We've got Marilyn Park in, who is the legislative representative for the National Veterans Affairs Council. We've got Dave Rodriguez in. Obviously, Marilyn, I didn't say this, but I should say, I guess, obviously, Marilyn will be doing the legislative training. We've got Dave Rodriguez, who's an outstanding member of field services for the Federation, to do the collective bargaining. We've got Stephanie Starks is the council representative on the joint training that we're doing on the master agreement. I think we've got some very educated trainers who are good at training people, which is, you know, the next step in that process. So it doesn't surprise us that we get very favorable reactions when the class evaluations are turned in from the students. And we expect that to continue. That's the way it's been before, and we expect that to continue.
And this triennial convention is really almost the tip of the iceberg, isn't it, given that throughout the year you're constantly putting on sessions and seminars and opportunities for the members to learn more and increase their skills?
We've scheduled a number of events. We do have a problem, which is a distinct problem, with the department in terms of getting them to join us in going out and doing the training. That's been... We thought we had resolved that problem, and we're conducting joint training because we think that the best training is joint training. That is when management and labor stand up in front of a room of management and labor and deliver the same message to those people so that everybody understands what is the proper interpretation of the provisions of the Master Collective Bargaining Agreement. But just recently, we've had a series of classes canceled because management is unwilling to continue. We had this problem, as I indicated, some years back. We thought we'd solved it, and now we're back again. Now, it may be that their management's pushback on this issue and their failure to go along with the program that we thought we had agreed to is simply due to their concern that we don't have, that we're so close to having a new collective bargaining agreement that they want to hold off on the training. But as I said, we're training now on the rollover provisions, which are the same, the articles are the same as the current contract and will be rolled over into the new contract. And there's a lot of them, and we think that given the fact that the training all too frequently is only a day long, you can barely get through the rolled over articles. But it is what it is.
Do you expect management to come around at some point and begin participating again?
Like, I do expect that when the new contract comes over, I'll take them at their word. And when the new contract is issued, and we hope and expect that it will be done in early February, that we can start up again and do the joint training that we want to do. But we also have a big desire to have just union-on-union training, too. Management has management-on-management training. They go out without us and give their idea of how things ought to go. And we need to do that for the union people because we don't agree on everything, even though we've got this contract that we agreed to. But there's a lot of things that aren't covered by the contract, and we think we need to train our people on those things, particularly the Chapter 71 of 5 U.S.C., which is the Labor Management Relations Statute, which is not part of the rollout training that we're going to be doing jointly. And with that, teach people about unfair labor practices and touch on things like negotiability issues and impasse proceedings.
Now, as everyone in the labor movement knows, the more people you have with you, the better you're going to be, the stronger you're going to be. And your council has really taken that to heart. Even most recently in May, you had a tremendous organizing drive where you recruited a number of new members to the council. Tell us about that drive and what it resulted in.
I'd be happy to. The Amalie came up with this idea of a $100 fee for the, or giving people $100 when they join AFGE, and also giving the recruiters $100. The event was really almost frighteningly successful from our point of view, because we had to come up with $100 for everybody to support this event. But it was terrific. I mean, my local picked up over 60 people in just the 1 month of May, and some locals exceeded that. Other locals didn't do as well, but overall, I think we picked up about 6,000 or so new members in May. I'm looking at Dorothy Jefferson, who's standing here at the table, and she's not saying no. So let's go with about 6,000 additional people, and we're about 85,000 now, and we're the biggest bargaining unit within the Federation. And that's just great news as far as I'm concerned, I think everybody else.
And explain to the audience what it really means to have 6,000 new members, or to have 85,000 total in your membership. How powerful does that make you when you're talking about working with management or working on Capitol Hill to get something done?
I think it's a demonstrable difference between a small local and a big local, between a small bargaining council and a big bargaining council. In the local area, I initially took over the local, and we were about 250 members. And when I left, we were 370, and that just that little difference meant that, and now we're over 500 under the new president, who's done a terrific job organizing. That little difference is the difference between being told, well, I can meet with you maybe next week, as opposed to I can meet with you now. And that actually happens, as surprising as it might sound to people who aren't familiar with this kind of activity. And Alma gets the attention of the secretary now, whereas I think she's always kind of gotten his attention, but now when she comes into town, just the news of that big surge in membership has gotten her in the door, and Jay David in the door as a National Secretary Treasurer to talk with Deputy Secretary Gould and Secretary Shinseki on occasion, and just get us to be able to talk to the assistant secretaries and not have to wait a week for that kind of conversation.
And talk about that for a minute, the work that you do with the leaders at the VA and some things that you have achieved and some things that you still hope to achieve.
Wow. We've got a whole ton of things we'd like to achieve, Jason. I don't think that anybody wants to hear me talk about all that stuff. I think that what has happened is a couple of issues that we've been pushing for a long time just kind of recently broke back in August. I say recently because we've been pushing them for so long that August seems recent, relatively speaking. We've had a number of issues with 38 U.S.C. 7422 and the way that the department's been interpreting that law. And we've got other issues with regard to kind of day-to-day issues, actually. Things like getting presidents released from to come to meetings, to come to training. Those kind of local issues Alma has been able to resolve on occasion. Nothing works out the way we'd really like it to, but it's definitely the case that she has been able to, just for this convention, she's been able to kind of smooth the way for several people to send somebody, or in some cases to send an extra person, an additional person. Doesn't always work out. Some local facilities are more intransigent than others in terms of listening to when national officers call them, as hard as that may be for the listeners to believe. There are some facility directors that when they get a call from a deputy assistant secretary or an assistant secretary, they're fairly prompt in giving in to the direction that's given to them. Others are just won't do it. Some of them regard themselves as the captain of a ship, and what they say goes, and no one can tell them otherwise. So It doesn't always work out the way we'd like it to, but it works out better when we have greater numbers of people paying dues.
And as we come into our last minute of the interview, give us a glimpse of what you're looking forward to doing for the VA Council.
That's an easy question, actually, although it would take more than a minute. But for openers, we have one legal representative now. I would like us to vote on Thursday for two more and fund those people. And because right now the current legal representative, the funding that we have is insufficient to actually pay her expenses. So we have to go into the general fund in order to finish paying her. And expenses. I mean, she's gone to Alaska and handled a claim. She's gone to Pittsburgh. That's not so expensive. Alaska, kind of expensive. And also, I think we want to do more, as I mentioned earlier, union-on-union training. I think that's a big desire that we have.
Bill Wetmore, AFGE National VA Council's third Executive Vice President, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Jake.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Save 10, 20, even 30% on PCs from Dell. Only Dell can offer AFGE members the guaranteed lowest price through their member purchase program. Visit Dell.com/AFGE for details.
Attention AFGE members, did you know you have free access to all federal government job listings at your fingertips? Through AFGE's partnership with AVIEW Technologies, you can view all available jobs, apply online, and be notified when a position of interest to you becomes available. View your application progress online 24/7. You'll even get information to make you a better job applicant. Simplify your next career move with AVIEW Technologies. Log on today and check out current job openings at afge.us. That's www.afge.us and click register.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by BJ Ocker, First District Representative for AFGE's National VA Council. BJ, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Jason.
So we're here at the VA Council's 20th Triennial Training Convention in Los Angeles. Tell us your thoughts of the convention so far.
Well, so we're just getting into the trainings, started yesterday afternoon. I think that we have a great and comprehensive group of programs that are available for our attendees to learn a lot about labor history, things to do with representation, including we're doing some work with the collaborative relations and focus on the new executive order on the labor forums.
And expand upon that a little bit. Tell us about it.
Well, through the Clinton administration, we developed partnerships so that we had a better opportunity to be at the table and to work pre-decisionally with management through issues that affected our workforce. And then during the Bush administration, they did away with that, although not all VA facilities also abolished their partnership. A lot of them maintained it. However, we've established some additional language and a little bit more meat on the bone, so to speak, with the new executive order that President Obama has put in place to establish labor forums at the national, at a regional, and a local level. And it gives us an opportunity to discuss some of those permissive subjects again. So it's an exciting time for us.
Explain to the audience how important it is for labor and management to be able to sit down and talk about the issues and work out any differences.
Well, the biggest thing is that we as the representatives are the voice of the people. And so what we bring forward to management is the thoughts and ideas that come from the workforce. And who better to know how to improve their work environment or to get things done more efficiently or more effectively than the workers that do it themselves?
The workers really are the experts at the workplace. Obviously, they do the work. They come in every day. And they have a lot of expertise to share with management about how things could be run better. Is that right?
That's correct. And there are programs out there. You know, the VA system is involved with the Malcolm Baldrige Quality Award through the Robert W. Carey program, which does allow employees to show, you know, be empowered to make effective change. However, they still have difficulties sometimes being able to step up and meet with management and to bring their ideas forward. And that's where we as union officials can assist them through the new executive order.
Now, talk about how management has responded to this with the resurgence of the labor management partnerships.
Well, I can speak at the VA level that, you know, we are in the process now of creating our national forums Part of what needs to be established with this is metrics, performance metrics for certain, for the different administrations, I should say. And so right now, the Veterans Benefits Administration has a pilot in place where they're looking at some of their performance metrics, and there's a pilot that's being developed between the union and the VBA upper management to see what we can do to improve the timeliness and flow of claims, processing claims through their programs.
And talk about that claims process a little bit and where you think improvements could be made.
First thing is, I want to say, before I even say that, is that the men and women that are the ones that do the ratings and the ones that work up these cases and try to provide the benefits to the soldiers and, you know, veterans that are well-deserving of anything, that they do an excellent job. And the demand is there. You see it in the newspapers. You hear it coming from Congress that, you know, we have a backlog of claims to process and so on. And some of there's a little truth to that, but some of it's also been skewed a little bit for the media. The fact of the matter is that what we're going to be trying to do through the benefits program is to streamline that process and make it more effective. One thing they're looking at is to actually go to an electronic record as opposed to having these piles and piles of documents. As an example, they may be looking for one specific document, and they may have to go through several hundred sheets in a folder to be able to find that. It's a very time-consuming process.
Whereas if it were electronic, then it would be searchable through a database or
That's
something.
That's correct.
Like. So talk a little bit about where you think that's going to go in a certain time frame. Is that something that could be resolved quickly, or...?
I think that, you know, when we look back at the VHA side and when we converted to electronic medical records, that it took a considerable amount of time for us to get to a point where we had that in place. And now we have what's considered one of the gold standards on electronic medical records in the world. And we have individuals from several places in different parts of the country that come see the VA system for how we maintain our medical records. So I think that it's there. It's just going to take us a while to be able to get that in place and make it a real effective system.
And you are teaching a course here at the convention, right?
That's correct. I'm going to be teaching this afternoon and on Friday morning, collaborative labor management relations. And that really goes a lot along with what we were talking about earlier, about how we can effectively get labor and management to work together, to sit down before issues arise. And and the goal is really to prevent a lot of the other formal actions that we have to take as union officials to get our opportunity to be part of the program. So instead of, you know, having to be in this adversarial role, that we can work collaboratively and make improvements.
And what kind of response do you get from the members when they have these opportunities to learn these subjects?
I know that we have I think we have somewhere in the vicinity of 130 members that have signed up to participate in our class, which I'm very excited to have that type of response, and hopefully that we can provide them information. I'm teaching this with management officials so that we together are going to be up in front showing that we are working collaboratively to provide this training and therefore give them tools that they can take back to their local facilities to try to promote good labor management relations at the local level.
It sounds like a wonderful opportunity to what you just said, you know, promote good labor management relations if at a convention like this, management participates in the training with you.
Absolutely.
So there's a lot happening with the VA Council, and you all are growing, is that right? You had
absolutely.
Tremendous organizing drive in May. Tell us about that.
Well, we're looking at the numbers, and actually over the last 3 years, looked at some of the data, and we actually increased our membership by 41%. Over the last 3 years. We took a risk here in the VA Council, which was paid in dividends that we'll be seeing for several years to come, by running an organizing drive and also awarding not only those that join, but those that recruit them with, you know, a couple $100s. And by doing so, we had a tremendous response.
Talk about how beneficial and helpful it is, really, when you're trying to get things done, maybe with management or on Capitol Hill legislatively, to be able to say, hey, in the last 3 years, we've increased our membership 41%. That's a lot of people behind us
who are fighting for these issues.
Well, I remember someone once told me that any individual equates to about 30 votes. So now you look at that, we have over 80,000 members in the National VA Council. And now you look at that and you multiply that by 30. That's a pretty strong voice, regardless if it's in Washington, if it's in your local community or within your state. And that's really the phrase that I use in our local, and the motto of our local is strength and unity. And it's that one collective voice going forward can make real effective change.
And the audience has to pay attention, whoever your audience is, whether it's Capitol Hill, whether it's the press, whether it's management. They have to listen to you when you have that many people behind you, right?
Absolutely. And when we represent, I think, close to three-quarters of all VA workers. And so that also has a significant impact when our president, Al Malee, goes down to central office and talks about concerns that are affecting the workforce.
Now, one issue where this increase in membership certainly can help, I would imagine, is the Title 38 issue, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's going to be a battle that we'll be fighting for some time to follow, you know, because of the fact that we need to make changes in legislation in order to provide them with the same collective bargaining rights that our other employees have, the same collective bargaining rights that other federal employees that are professional Title 30 employees and other agencies have. So that's the fight we haven't given up, and we'll continue to try to push to be able to make those changes.
And just so that we're clear for the audience, this isn't over money. This is over basic workplace rights.
That's correct. And some have argued that care to veterans is going to be diminished, or be, you know, their safety is going to be compromised. There's not going to be any changes whatsoever in the delivery of care that we provide to our country's veterans. What we're going to be doing is providing and protecting the rights of those employees, just like the Title V employees that they work with side by side every day.
And this seems like a similar issue to our transportation security officers, who are also engaged in a battle for really just basic workplace protections.
That's correct.
It's something that all other federal employees have, and why certain groups are singled out is hard to explain, isn't it?
Well, I think the easy way to explain it is that because then people are threatened. People in a management position are threatened because now they don't have total control and authority over these individuals. You know, they can fire them at will. They can discipline them for things that are just completely egregious, you know, and ridiculous reasons. And so they don't want us to be able to represent these individuals, because they know that we'll be there to be on watch and to prevent such those types of acts from occurring.
And so what do you think it will take to get these bargaining rights granted?
It's going to take us as union activists to get organized, to get up on Capitol Hill and push those issues, to talk with your senators and congressmen in your state, to get your members out there, your members' families out there, and for us to get the message and educate people all over the country as to what we're trying to do and why it's important.
As we come into our last 30 seconds here, we're going to give you the last word.
I just want to say it's been so far a phenomenal convention. I want to say congratulations to Ms. Al Malee, Ms. M.J. Burke, Mr. Oscar Williams, and Mr. Bill Wetmore on being reelected, along with Ms. Dorothy Jefferson, our treasurer. And I look forward to serving our council and AFGE in the future. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today.
BJ, thank you, as always, for your time.
Have a great day.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Thank you to our guest this week, Congressman John Sarbanes, AFGE 6th District National Vice President Arnold Scott, National VA Council 3rd Executive Vice President Bill Wetmore, and 1st District Representative B.J. Ocker. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Dell, and AV Technologies.